Welcome to a History of Horror podcast, a year-long journey through films throughout the decades, examining across the globe what makes us scared. Christopher Brown. Today I want to talk to you about exploitation and a certain word that has kind of been entangled with exploitation as well. At the start of our journey, I initially started talking a great deal about exploitation, kind of saying that cinema came from it, from carnivals and from Edison. When we spoke about the 50s, we spoke about gimmicks to sell films from William Castle. All of this comes obviously from an exploitation background. And these days in the UK, certainly in the last 10 years, and in the US for far longer, when we think about exploitation, we think about a phrase called grindhouse. Now, when I say that, you probably get a very particular impression now. One generated from the Tarantino and Rodriguez film and the B-movies that kind of came after that. Direct-to-video releases with nude nuns with big guns and that kind of thing. Films that use a digital crackle on top of the action to kind of give the impression of a battered old 35mm or 16mm reel. And because of that, because of the way those films are appointed, exploitation can sometimes appear to be a bit of a cheap trick rather than something else.
It was called The Grindhouse. Theaters that played back-to-back movies featuring uncensored sexuality and hardcore thrills. Now, Tarantino and Rodriguez are bringing The Grindhouse back with two explosive feature films. First,
they're stealing biochemical weapons.
When the laws of science are broken, the last hope for humanity rests in the hands of a few. Doc Block, his prescription, pain.
We gotta lose the arm, Joe.
What do you mean lose arm? My arm?
Dakota, one hot mama who knows the score.
If anyone comes to the door, I want you to run.
What if it's Dad?
Hello, baby.
Especially if it's your dad.
El Rey, cross him and it's lights out. And Jerry Darling.
I made you something.
She tastes like trouble. With an attitude to boot. In Robert Rodriguez, Planet Terror.
Then.
Buckle up. Because a new kind of terror is coming. At 200 miles per hour.
Ladies, we're gonna have some fun.
There are a few things as fetching as a bruised ego on a beautiful angel.
Is that cowboy wisdom?
I'm not a cowboy, Pam. I'm a stuntman.
Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof.
This car is 100% death proof. Only to get the benefit of it, honey, you really need to be sitting in my seat.
Two adrenaline-fueled roller coasters. One ticket to ride. In 2.5 hours of pure dynamite. Planet Terror and Death Proof. Only at the Grindhouse.
So grindhouse is like an American term, really. The English didn't come up with it. And that covers this concept of exploitation films. Now, according to the historian David Church, it was the theatre type that kind of generated the reason for this name, where it was But, you know, we normally would associate Grindhouse with, say, 70s and 42nd Avenue. But in this case, it's more to do with the, you know, early 1920s, where films would just be shown continually at and the tickets would be cheap, and you know would only kind of rise in price, you know, during more peak times. You know, it kind of went against the other model, which was fewer shows and a ticket price basically working like it does in the theatre, with the good seats being more expensive than the cheap seats at the back. Now, this was mainly based on the fact that these cinema theatre spaces were old theatres, so the cheap seats could be have you right in the gods, and the screen was just huge. However, because they were cheap, grindhouses were you know, attracting slightly more dubious audiences, perhaps. And therefore, these policies of just continually showing films all the time kind of gave the theatres an air of maybe illicitness. And because of, you know, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy of, you know, they wouldn't be able to show first run theatrical runs. It would have to be second runs or old reels that have kind of done the rounds around the country. And if it was slightly newer stuff, it had to be imported in, and as such was kind of more salacious in their content. Now, a lot of this gets summed up with 42nd Street in New York. Now, there's a great documentary on the Anthropophagus Blu-ray and DVD called 42nd Street Memories, which kind of gives like the... it's like an 80-minute run through the entire history of that street, from kind of prestigious theatres through to... rather dingy exploitation fare, showing things like Let Them Die Slowly in the 70s and 80s, through to what it is now, which is, you know, Disney-fied theatre entertainment. So Grindhouse kind of became associated not with the fact that they were grinding the films out all the time, but that, you know, from the 70s and 80s, that people were, you know, it was so close to burlesque shows and, you know, bump and grind kind of places that it kind of, you know, filtered in to the concept of what those things were. And in that case, incredibly sleazy. Indeed, in 1943's Lady of Burlesque film, the burlesque show on 42nd was called a grindhouse. So it's not without precedent. So this, you know, at that point, you know, it could be kind of churning out films, but you know, with TV eroding audiences for local and single screen movie theaters, many that were built in the cinema boom of the 30s, and because of people moving out of the area, those areas had to show something that kind of to drag people in, shall we say. Things that you couldn't show on TV. So we're looking at the growth of pornography such as deep throat, sleaze, slasher horror, and martial arts films from Hong Kong that, you know, just different, extreme, unusual stuff. So, you know, we've got sex and violence, bizarre, you know, but not just that, but also like, you know, kind of rapey kind of films, roughies as they're called, you know, quite horrible stuff, really, to a point. Those of you who listen to my Video Nasties podcast will know I'm talking about films that, you know, like Love Camp 7 or like the early films of Herschel Gordon Lewis. It was sexploitation, basically. And of course, because these films were low-budget efforts, the quality could vary wildly. But the screenings could, you know, effectively, were there just to make a buck, you know what I mean? So it wasn't really, the quality didn't match as much as the fact that they had something they could show that was cheap. So... film directors like Andy Gillion, who a fascinating guy, and I speak about him on the Video Nasties podcast about Blood Rights. You know, a really interesting bloke. But when you look at him in terms of what he achieved, it's you know, and the quality of his work, it's very, you know, it's very rough and ready, to say the least. So this and this kind of stuff died out. It died out in the, you know, in the 80s and 90s. In the same way, in the UK now, you know, we can get, you know, you can get a nice Blu-ray of Zombie Holocaust, which in the US is called it Dr. Butcher MD. You know, it, as you can, you know, and it's it looks great. You know what I mean? It's as good as that film's ever going to look. You know, you have that and you put that against something like, I don't know, I mean, you know, you're going out to see that kind of entertainment or going out to see pornography when, you know, you've got the internet. It seems bizarre that you would. And that's where it kind of like, it went quiet for a long time. Now, this idea, therefore, is a wide and broad church. It films lots of different films and lots of different ideas. And then Robert Rodriguez made Planet Terror and Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof, released together as a double bill called Grindhouse in 2007, became a homage to a genre that didn't really exist. It was more a homage to a feel and a mood and an idea than a reality. You know, Planet Terror, with all its CG action, you know, is not comparable to a film like Zombie Flesh Eaters, also known as Zombie in the US, or Zombie Holocaust, or indeed Cannibal Holocaust. These films are, you know, quite, you know, feasibly quite slow, with quite extreme violence in them to kind of suck people in. But, you know, it's very much the attempts of the art in terms of, you know, how it's sold, which seems to have attracted Tarantino and Rodriguez to talk about them. And indeed, you know, for me personally, with Grindhouse, the best elements of that film are the trailers, which kind of ramps up the exploitation value with obviously Machete, Thanksgiving, which is the Eli Roth film, which does feel look like a slasher trailer, if not a slasher film from that time. Don't, and which is Edgar Wright's effort, and Rob Zombie's very on the nose but quite funny. Werewolf Women of the SS, which again kind of plays up to the absurdities, kind of like making it almost cartoonish. But that Grindhouse film has created its own genre. So you get films like Chillerama, Drive Angry, numerous straight-to-video efforts which kind of play up on the kind of charms of this kind of era. And even computer games kind of get in there as well, with like House of the Dead and for the Wii and Rage, and kind of playing up on these Grindhouse homages. In the UK, we kind of see it, you know, exploitation is seen, you know, in two different facets. One is the video nasties scare, which I'll get onto on its own, with the kind of boom of VHS. But also, sexploitation films, which are far more, far like, you know, looser, a lot closer to the white coats and softcore sexploitation of US, but distinctly British. So the Confessions of a Window Cleaner, which are effectively just, you know, sexier, more nudity-strewn versions of Carry On movies. But not horror, so let's move on. But this is where I'm getting to, and this is what I want to talk about today. Not a very long podcast today. I mean, I feel like we need to address this, but I don't want to, like, you know, go on for an hour about films that, you know, if you want to look at the masses of horror stuff that kind of touches on this, you know, look at Wes Craven's Last House on the Left. Look at George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead. Toby Hooper. Texas Chainsaw, those kind of 70s and 80s, they're the breakthrough hits from that kind of era. Lucio Fulci, Dario Argento, you know, we can pull all the best stuff that kind of falls into this Grindhouse kind of bin. We can pull out anyway in different eras and different genres, so we don't really need to kind of make it special on its own. The only thing I have, you know. So let's talk about films. For me, therefore, Grindhouse feels like a marketing gimmick still. And it is a marketing gimmick. It was always a marketing gimmick at the time, you know. Dr. Butcher MD, when that came out, had had some actors, some scantily clad nurses on the back of a flatbed truck, kind of doing fake surgery up and down the streets of, 42nd Street and Broadway and all that kind of stuff, trying to drum up attention, got arrested by the police and then going out and doing it again. The 42nd Street Memories idea is effectively that documentary is lots of really influential and wonderful people involved with horror and film generally, all kind of looking at it and kind of saying, right, this was a great time for me because it was my youth. It informed me. It made me interested in film, Basket Case and that kind of stuff. And those films like that came out of it, Frankenhooker. And obviously, we'll get on to Eli Roth's work when we talk about more modern American films. But, he is influenced by a period of time that is almost certainly there. When you look at a film like, The Green Inferno, that is influenced by the cannibal movies of the early 80s, and very almost exclusively. So Cannibal Holocaust and Cannibal Ferox in particular. But films that kind of fall into that trap, which are effectively low-budget films that were built for drive-in circuits for these cinemas that just churn out stuff. So grinding theatres and low-budget circuits, that elevate themselves above. So the obvious one would be Sam Raimi's Evil Dead, which was made in the early 80s. Again, I have a quite long episode about this film if you want to go back and listen to it on the Video Nasties podcast. But, that was built, driven by a couple of young lads, quite a few young lads, who wanted to make a film, filmed on 16mm in a cabin over a long period of time because they kept on running out of money with dentist money, and then was released in the public and designed to be shown on, well, whatever screen they could. It was filmed in 4:3 because it's filmed on 16mm. But they haven't really paid much attention to Matten, probably because they realised that the projectionist probably wouldn't pay that much attention to Matten. So it works as a 4:3 presentation, but also there is it can be matted into 16 to a standard widescreen format as well. And it has that feel, and it's designed to be, as much as it can be to kind of deliver shocks and scares. So there's that side of stuff in terms of those kind of films that would be classed as grindhouse or drive-in features that also have far more, nous to them. But there's another side of stuff as well. Let's take, for example, Let's Scare Jessica to Death from 1971. Now, it's directed by John Hancock, and it stars Jura Lampert as Jessica. Now, it's about a woman who is psychologically fragile on an old farmhouse in Connecticut. And it's a film that is very low budget, but because of its quality, in terms of actually being frightening and actually being very different, it's kind of elevated itself beyond what you would normally class as, like, just standard and driving fodder, which, to be fair, is, more than 40 years old now. For example, in 2006, the Chicago Film Critics Association pronounced it one of the scariest films ever made. It's about a woman called Jessica who's been released on a six-month stay in a mental institution. And her husband, a guy called Duncan, has given up his job as a string bassist for the New York Philharmonic and bought a house located on a farm with an orchard known as the Old Bishop Place in Connecticut. When they get there, they find a mysterious drifter called Emily, who's already living there. When Emily kind of says, listen, I better leave because obviously I'm not meant to be here, Jessica says, listen, stay the night. When Woody, who's a friend of theirs, makes it obvious that he's actually attracted to Emily, Jessica says she should like her to stay. But Jessica starts hearing voices, seeing a mysterious blonde woman looking at her from a distance. And suddenly she seems to be grabbed underwater by a mysterious hand and is terrified to discuss about it. So Jessica starts seeing things and is reacting to the world around her in quite nightmarish ways. And those around her appear to be becoming increasingly hostile. And we start to wonder exactly what's happening in the house and how much Jessica has control of her own life and how much is it being manipulated around her. Its benefit is that it's quite an eerie sounding film, quite odd and a little bit off. There's a lot of good quality, very low budget film from this time, which is, you know, very, very beautifully shot. Early 70s kind of feel and tone to it, which really does help kind of tell its story. Kim Newman, in his book Nightmare Movie, says the following of the film. In Jessica's paranoid nightmare, the unfriendly townsfolk who scrape the word love off the side of the hearse she drives because it's cheaper than a station wagon become shambling vampire ghouls, and her husband, Barton Heyman, is about to turn into one of them. Jessica predates Robert Altman's Images, 1974, in its use of autumnal countryside to reflect the mental collapse of the heroine. While Susanna York's psychosis fractures into a series of role-playing charades, Zora Lampert's extraordinary delicate character study shades into a terrifying acceleration of disorientating images. In one of the most unusually haunting moments in the cinema, Emma sinks beneath the waters of the lake, dressed in a black bathing suit, only to bob up moments later wearing a sodden 19th century wedding dress.
Calling on all the spirits of everyone who's ever died in this house.
Jessica.
I'm calling on all the spirits of everyone who's ever died in this house.
Jessica.
Paramount Pictures presents Let's Scare Jessica to Death.
You've been following me.
What's the matter with him?
She knows who killed that man.
What man?
I don't know. He was lying right here. But I swear it's true. I think that the same creature or whatever it is that killed the antique dealer killed them all.
I think you should go back to New York for a while. You could see your doctor.
I was just looking at the picture. Looks so much like you.
My eyes. Look in my eyes. Come with me. Come with me. Follow me, Jessica. Follow me. I won't go away.
Another example of this kind of cinema which kind of accelerates and improves around it in a way that you wouldn't normally expect is Axe, also known as Lisa Lisa, which again is notable for being one of the video nasties. And indeed, there is I've also touched on it on the Video Nasties podcast. That's a film, one, the nature of the story Sounds incredibly just like exploitation. A group of three psychopaths on the run from the law, kill a man and flee into the countryside. They end up in an isolated farm, which is a home of a young girl named Lisa and her paralyzed grandfather. After suffering humiliation on the hands of the gang, Lisa decides to take revenge. Now that sounds pretty standard stuff. And indeed, on the trailers, it's sold either as, you know, the house is like, you know, Lisa in the house is a psycho and these lads have kind of rocked up into it and are victims. Or the other side of the trailer is it kind of says the truth of the story in terms of the fact that this is a girl who steps up and is attacked and then defends herself by these psychopaths. What's notable about Axe is, again, you know, despite its age and the fact it was made in the 70s and was shot on location in North Carolina, it was directed in a way that it's so well photographed. In fact, its director, who is Frederick Friedel, he directs it in such a... He's actually a stills photographer, and he directs it in such a way that, the shots are beautifully shot, despite the fact that so much of it, because of the low amount of film stock they had to be done in one take. So you have this kind of, like, some of the scenes just don't work because, they really should have been reshot. And the grandfather, played by Douglas Powers, is meant to be, you know, mentally very feeble and unable to move, but because, you know, he just moves around so much in the film because of, you know, different, you know, continuity issues and the fact that, you know, he's just not that good at doing what he's doing. But Leslie Lee as Lisa is a strong central performance. It's very short, at 72 minutes, film 16mm, but Friedel has an eye for some very beautiful shots, and indeed the opening shot of the farmhouse is very pretty, and that just juxtaposes lovely with the harsh neon and the electric lights of the initial crimes that were done to kind of introduce our psychopathic characters. It's actually sold very much as exploitation, which is why it kind of fits so nicely in this grindhouse thing titled Axe, or the California Axe Massacre. It kind of insinuates that the of horrendous action and a terrible gore, when the film itself actually is very tame. It got wrapped up in the Video Nasties scare more because of its cover than because of any of the contents within. And a part of that's because, you know, it has Harry Novak, the legendary producer, presenting the film. But really, he was just the distributor who put his name on the top of the film so it would sell more copies. So the story of exploitation is very much the story of cinema, in a way, or certainly a certain type of cinema. We kind of, you know, we touch on exploitation throughout our journey, from, you know, 1930s and 40s carnival films, which are effectively, although not horror, kind of cautionary tales avoiding the use of drugs, such as Reefer Madness. Through to biker films, blaxploitation, and then obviously the more obvious stuff, which you've already spoken about, such as the cannibal movies, or giallo. We even spoke briefly about Mondo films, although again, they're not really horror, they're just there to elicit an emotional reaction. And I'm sure that when we go to, you know, Video Nasties and that kind of stuff, which again is a flare point where a lot of these kind of things all come together, we'll again discuss more. But what I really wanted to say today, and I hope I've kind of pulled this across, is that I feel like the idea of grindhouse, which I'll be honest with you, was fairly new to the UK before Rodriguez films. We called them exploitation films, and we called the cinemas flea pits. Is kind of been skewered by an almost, like, you know, 18 plus Disney-esque aesthetic, you know, the absurdity of Rose McGowan with a gun for a leg, over, for example, what these films were really like. And yeah, you know, you look at a film, and I've said it before, you know, like Zombie Holocaust, and it is kind of like that. But, you know, how it was sold is far more of an example of what it's like than, you know, than the actual film itself. And, you know, I've got nothing against Dr. Butcher, M.D. I think it's a great, fun film. And, you know, that Blu-ray that's just come out. It's a lovely, lovely bloat. But at the same time, I think, you know, we need to look beyond. It's such a wide and varied pool, and it's so intrinsically tied with the, you know, with our history of horror generally, that it's too easy to pigeonhole what is such a wide variety of films. You know, any pool of films that you can include: Rocky Horror Picture Show, Pink Flamingos, and SS Experiment Camp in, and not even blink an eyelid, and that's just one side of stuff. Then I think, you know, you need to kind of, you know, consider that as being far too wide a pool just to class as a genre. You know, Eraserhead, The Harder They Come, Night of the Living Dead, you know, it's too broad. And there's a fantastic story actually on that 42nd Street Memories, which says, you know, somebody showed Vigilante and E.T. on a double bill. Now, I don't know who was bringing the kids to go and see Vigilante. I don't know if they kind of shuffled in halfway through for E.T. But from that point of view, you know, is E.T. an exploitation film? Or is it just how those films were kind of packaged together for a dubious audience really willing for illicit thrills?
Stay away from Lisa. You will never leave alive. Dear God, no. All men are drawn to Lisa.
This place will do just fine.
What was the madness here? What terror? Get out! Escape if you can! Lisa, you'll die to know her secret. Lisa!
That was a short but quite strange introduction to the kind of ideas that I was talking about. I hope you enjoyed it. Hope it was you weren't really expecting more than that. I think, you know, as I said, I mean, exploitation is quite broad, and we need to kind of, you know, we touch on it so much in our journey that it's easy to kind of forget that, you know, it is in itself a genre, even if, in my view, it possibly shouldn't be. Speaking of films that could end up you up on in exploitation houses, we're going to look next time at Mexican horror and films from South America, which is one of those another broad church kind of topics. But we'll focus on Mexico and we'll broaden out when we need to. So if you'd like to get in contact with me, please do. My email address is historyofhorrorpodcast@gmail.com. You can go to historyhorrorpodcast.com and leave a comment on any of the articles. And there's also loads of videos as well. Or you can come to me with on my Twitter account, which is @orange_monkey. So until then, take care. I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.